Great. So we're very happy to have Angelo Esposito today. Angelo is currently a postdoc at EPFL in Switzerland. And today he will tell us about primordial non-Gaussianities from consistency relations of larger scale structure. So feel free to start.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks for the invitation. Yeah, so feel free to stop me, complain whenever you want. I'm a good sport, I can take it, I think, I hope. But yeah, so this is, I'm gonna try to talk to you about this, essentially this possibility of determining primordial non-Gaussianities using large-scale structure, and in particular using large-scale structure in a regime that has not been employed so far, okay? And it will mostly base, what I'm gonna talk about is will mostly be based on this paper here with Romanzco Cimarro and Lan Hui, plus some work in progress, which I hope is soon to be paper, with the same people, plus Max Ebibol, which is at Oxford. Okay, the usual brief outline. I will give you an intro to what consistency relations are. I don't know if it's a familiar thing. I might be saying stuff that for many people are trivial, but I think I want to make a very simple point, so I'll try to build it in a sort of a pedagogical way. And in particular, I will try to give you a very brief, three slides long derivation of consistency relations, if you allow me, because I think it's a good way of underlying what assumptions lie behind the consistency relations. And then I'll show you how we can test these statements, these consistency relations, using n-body simulations, and in particular, how we can use consistency relations to test inflationary models. And then another second part, quite long, it will be dedicated to essentially what's the long-term plan for this program, okay? What we are planning to do to essentially make it useful for real data. All right. Okay, so, well, okay, as you probably know, the oldest question probably in cosmology is what are the initial conditions of our universe, okay? In particular, was inflation driven by only one field, or were there other light degrees of freedom that played a role? Or even, I don't know, even more dramatically, is inflation the real mechanism, the correct mechanism to explain the universe as it is today? And the standard approach, if I understand correctly, to this problem is to essentially consider, you take your data, you consider modes in the linear or quasi-linear regime, which means that modes that are at long enough wavelength, so that standard perturbation theory, including maybe loop corrections, but essentially standard perturbation theory applies and gives real predictions. You use those predictions to test your data, to test the model on your data. And essentially, if I understand correctly, what you do for hard modes, for nonlinear modes, that, for example, for large scale structure are modes that are harder than 0.2 inverse megaparsec, you just discard them, essentially because you don't have a theory model to compare the data with. Okay. The problem is that short wavelength modes, meaning large momenta modes, are very abundant and they're very well measured. You know, it's much easier to measure precisely something that is close in space than something that is very far away. Okay. So it would be good to have some sort of alternative approach to try to employ this part of the data as well. And one possibility that we are proposing is this use of, to use these consistency relations. So very schematically speaking, I will go in more detail in a bit, but consistency relations are essentially statements that relate endpoint correlators to endpoint n plus one point correlators, where the additional leg is a soft leg. So it's taken in the limit of zero momentum or infinite wavelength, if you want. And you know, if you're more familiar with particle physics, this is the cosmological analog of the soft pion theorem. Soft pion theorem tells you that you have a, if you have some particle amplitude with an external soft pion, you can relate that amplitude in the soft limit to the amplitude where there is no pion. Okay. It's a worded entity, as I'll show you. It will be a worded entity. Okay. But the nice thing is that being a worded entity, meaning that since it follows solely from symmetry, is fully non-perturbative. And in particular, it means that beside this mode Q, which is taken soft by definition, the other modes can in principle be as hard as you want. So they could be deep into the nonlinear regime where perturbation theory typically does not apply. And there is a tremendous amount of theoretical work done on this, okay, to which I've contributed essentially zero. But the people found a whole different bunch of consistent simulations in different contexts. The very first one was pointed out by Maldacena in the context of cosmological perturbations, scalar perturbations. But the one that we will be more interested in was pointed out first by, well, actually almost at the same time, by Kehajas and Riotto and Pelosa and Pietroni. And they are the consistent simulations for large-scale structure, meaning for matter over density in the universe, but also galaxy fluctuations, for example. Plus a bunch of other stuff, okay? So there is a lot of theoretical work behind these consistent simulations. Maybe it's a good time to try to put them into, you know, some firm practical grounds to see if we can use them. And so let me give you an introduction to what they are, even though maybe you already guessed it. But, you know, typically we are very familiar with the consequences of linearly realized symmetries, right? For example, if we consider spatial translations and a certain field delta, which for us will be the matter density, we know that under a translation, delta will shift by a certain quantity, which is essentially given by its gradient. And the transformation is therefore linear on delta itself. And we know that the consequence of these is essentially that endpoint functions are also translational invariant, if you want by conservation, or if you want conservation of momentum, okay? This is what we are typically used to. It's nice, but it is a bit boring. Typically, things get more interesting when you have non-linearly realized symmetries, okay? And the ones that I will be interested in are the symmetries of large-scale structure, okay? The simplest form for the equation for large-scale structure is this one. You have, you probably know those already, but you have an equation for the matter density, okay? Which is essentially the conservation of mass. You have an equation for the velocity of your matter, which is the conservation of momentum. And you probably know them as Euler and continuity equation. And then finally you have the Poisson equation, which is actually non-dynamical. It's just, it's a constraint that for every value of the density gives you the gravitational potential, okay? So these are the simplest version of equation of motion for large-scale structure, okay? And you can show that these enjoy actually two non-linearly realized symmetries. The first one is simply a constant shift in the gravitational potential, of course, because it always appears derived. So if you shift it by a constant, nothing changes. And the second one is a little bit funkier, is a time-dependent spatial translation, meaning that you can now perform a spatial translation with a vector that now depends on time. And if you supplement this with a particular shift of the gravitational potential that is proportional to space, and the corresponding shift in the velocity, this is still a symmetry of the equations of motion, okay? But as you see, these are non-linear in the field, meaning that these and these do not depend on the field itself. In fact, I should probably say sublinear, meaning that they just don't depend on the field, okay? But when you have something like that, we have ordered entities that are a bit more interesting, and I'll show you how to derive them, but just to give you the punchline, if you impose these two symmetries here on your correlators, what you find are the consistent relations for large-scale structure. And in particular, you have these two. They look a little bit complicated, but you see they're essentially relations. Oh, this is a typo. There is no delta Q here. So sorry. They are relations between n plus one point function and n point function. There should be no delta of Q here. Okay. Just like I showed you before, just like the soft pion theorem and everything else. But in particular, they take a very simple form if you consider equal time, meaning these tau A's are the time at which you are measuring every fluctuation delta A, right? And if you assume that you are measuring fluctuations all at the same time, essentially the right-hand side of this guy here vanishes as well. And you only end up with the statement that this quantity and its derivative vanish in the soft limit. which means that if you express this function here divided by the power spectrum as a series in Q, this function has no poles in Q, neither a Q to the one nor a Q to the minus two. It's a regular function of Q. This is the simplest version you can have of these consistency relations. And there's two things should be said. The first one is that I haven't specified anything about these modes, K1 to Kn. They can be arbitrarily hard, and they will be arbitrarily hard in what we've done in the following. And another thing is that this assumption of equal time is not that unreasonable, because eventually we know that hard modes, we have to measure hard modes, of course, within our observable horizon, and they cannot be too far apart from each other in time, okay? But that being said, one should be careful about how far apart in time they can be, because there might be corrections to this statement here due to unequal time measurements, okay? Is this clear so far, at least schematically? Okay, so this is the statement. And as I'll show you, consistency relations are robust, again, because they follow solely from symmetry. However, they can be violated, and that's what makes them interesting. Okay, because the fact that they can be...
Angelo, may I interrupt here? So
yes.
Just to say that the symmetry is actually more general than the symmetry of these simple equations, because you can still simplify equations for logical structure, right? Just do it, which is not exact, yeah?
Yes, you can.
But the symmetry here really comes from equivalence principle, which is...
I will comment on this at the very end. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want, you can have... Yeah, I have two or three slides on that. But essentially, just to give you a peak, you can have very astrophysically messy observables in principle, like galaxy formations. And for example, if you consider galaxies, we know that now galaxies can be destroyed, they can form, and it's a very complicated physics, but essentially the only thing that you assume, as you're saying, is frame independence, if you want, of these interactions. And once you have done that, consistency relations hold the same.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so let me put it this way, I'm presenting them this way in the easiest way possible, because this way we can see how they come around, and especially mm-hmm. what we are assuming. But then towards the end of the talk, I will tell you how to make this more and more realistic, including the more complicated stuff,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which eventually is what we want to do. Right now, we have done it only for the simplest case of just matter fluctuations, but eventually we want to have a recipe on how to use consistency relation on real data, on real galaxy surface.
Yeah, there will be a more subtle thing, and I think that you will discuss that Gaussianity of initial conditions is also somewhere. So
absolutely, yeah. This is going to be in three slides, I think. Or
okay, good.
But that's the whole point. We want to show that consistency relations are precisely able to probe depth, these mm-hmm. subtle things.
Okay, good.
And exactly because of that, they are interesting because there are things that could go wrong about consistency relations, and could therefore change their shape, their form, if you want, at least. And the fact that consistency relation can be violated, it's great, because it means that it's meaningful to test them on data. If there were relations that are always true for any physical system, they would be boring, and there would be no point to test them on data. But they can be violated, and there are, in fact, known examples where they are violated. When I say violated, I typically mean that they are slightly modified. For example, that Q to the minus two or Q to the minus one poles do appear, but you still have a relation between N plus one and N minus one point functions. They're not what you would predict normally. And so there is physics that we can learn from testing consistency relations on data. But to do that, we need to clarify what are the underlying assumptions, so that once we know, well, if we see a violation, we know what that means, okay? So if you allow me, I'll give you a super brief proof of consistency relations. I might be cavalier about some stuff. I don't think so, but maybe. But I think this highlights the main steps, okay? And stop me if this is unclear. So I like to use a functional integral formalism. So essentially, the idea is the following. Consider some endpoint function for the density profile, okay? Now, we know that this is a classical field, okay? But it's still a random field. And we know that the expectation value of a random field, you can write it down as some functional integral of the field itself times some probability distribution for this field, okay? And here I've been a bit lazy. By phi, I mean both density profile and velocity. Okay, it's a collection of fields that includes both the density and the velocity. Okay. But now, since this is a functional integral, I can perform a field redefinition, okay, by a shift that then it will be my symmetry, but for now it doesn't have to be. I can perform a field redefinition. And since it's just a change of variables, the functional integral has to stay the same. And from that, we derive this equation here, where you see this is nothing but the change in the product of the densities themselves. And this instead is the change in the probability distribution, which would be crucial for us. Okay. Because, so this part is the trivial part that you would have guessed anyways. Okay. What is the change in the probability distribution? Well, the probability distribution here is quite simple to write in the sense that this is not a quantum system, meaning there is only one trajectory. You follow the equations of motion, meaning the field profile at a certain time t is given by the solution of the equations of motion. But what gives you the stochastic nature of the field is the fact that the initial conditions are stochastic. So you have fluctuations in the initial conditions, but for any given initial condition, the equation of motion evolve your field down to late times, okay? So the probability distribution for the field at late time is nothing but something that tells you that you have to be on the equations of motion, averaged or integrated over the initial conditions, times the probability distribution for the initial conditions. And here I decided to write things in terms of pi, which is actually the potential, the velocity potential, meaning it's a scalar field such that its gradient is the velocity. You could do everything in terms of delta. It's just that pi, it's the one that resembles the most a real Goldstone in this old language. But it doesn't quite matter at the end. So there's that. And now we gotta ask ourselves, okay, how does this probability distribution changes when I perform this change of variables, okay? And well, okay, you perform a change of variable in the probability distribution. You end up with these. And you see, the first thing that you can do is to do exactly the same change of variables also on these initial conditions and shift these. And now it comes the first assumption. The first assumption is that this transformation delta is a symmetry of the equations of motion. If it's a symmetry of the equations of motion, it means that the solution to the equation of motion that starts from the transformed initial condition will give you the transformed solution, which is that this returns the initial delta, and the only thing that you are left with is the change of the probability distribution for the initial conditions. And now you have the second assumption that comes in, which is the most important, is what Sergei was saying also. Typically, what people do is to assume Gaussian initial conditions, single field Gaussian initial conditions for this field. Okay, essentially, that the probability distribution for the initial condition is a quadratic Gaussian integral with some weight that is, it's technically it's the initial time power spectrum, but it's not that relevant for us. Okay, it's just it's quadratic. Okay, is this clear so far? And if this is the probability distribution for the initial conditions, we know very well how that transforms, because we know how pi transforms. You have a linear term and you have a nonlinear term, okay? And you can input that in the probability distribution and find that the change in the initial condition probability distribution is precisely this. And you see, because of the nonlinear part of the transformation of pi, you have the limit for q that goes to zero. Because something that is pi independent in real space, it gives you a delta function in q space. But there is a third assumption that enters here, which is super subtle, and I didn't appreciate it until like I think two weeks ago, when I was reading some stuff to give this seminar. And is the fact that you have to assume that whatever transformation you see, this n, if you remember, is this time-dependent translation that we performed on the field. You have to assume that this time-dependent translation has the same time dependence as the growing physical mode. And it's a little subtle because I think at first it was believed that the only thing that you need to assume is that it has the time dependence of a physical mode, which is called, you know, it's called the adiabatic mode condition. But it turns out that that's actually not true. You need to assume also that that time dependence is the time dependence of the growing mode. So it is called the physical mode condition. It was clarified recently by Lam, Hu, and Austin Joyce and company. And this is another important assumption, because as I'll show you, there are models that violate these assumptions. Meaning there are models that do not violate the adiabatic mode condition, but they do violate the physical mode condition, meaning that your transformation, it does obey the equations of motion, but it's not the leading solution to the equation of motion.
Angelo, I'm confused. So
yes.
So adiabatic mode is the growing mode usually.
So. No, actually not necessarily, because if you read, for example, Weinberg's very first paper, right, mm-hmm. on this adiabatic, the only thing that he claims is you need to have essentially the parameter of your transformation has to match the Q to zero limit of a physical solution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that might not be the growing solution. For example, I'll mention this, but if you take, in most of the case it is, okay, so single field inflation, slow roll, it is.
Mm-hmm.
But for example, if you look at, and I'm not an expert in the fine details of this model, but if you look at ultra slow roll inflation, you know, this mm-hmm. model where you have a perfectly flat potential with a huge initial kinetic energy,
mm-hmm.
You can find a transformation parameter that is a solution to the mm-hmm. equations of motion. Essentially, in that case, as you said, your transformation is nothing but diffs, large diffs.
Mm-hmm.
And you can show that the Q to zero limit of these large diffs is actually constant.
Mm-hmm.
But for ultra slow roll, for the ultra slow roll model, the constant solution is not the growing, is not the dominant one. There is another solution that grows.
Right.
And in fact, you can show that in that limit, you have consistency relations, but they only apply at initial time, meaning if the soft mode is computed at initial time. To evolve the soft mode to final time so that you can use it in measurements, you need to assume that the large diffs not only go as a physical, as a solution to the equations of motion, but they go as the growing solution to the equation of motion. And in fact, ultra slow roll inflation, despite the fact that in principle is a single field inflation, so one might think that consistency relations are respected, they are not. And
Right.
But it's because you have two modes, and none of them becomes negligible at late time. So you have effectively as if you had another clock.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
There's this very nice discussion in Lam's, it's one of the latest papers that Lam wrote about it, where they clarify all these subtleties, and they exactly discriminate between adiabatic mode condition, meaning in the language that I'm presenting here, essentially that eta of tau is a solution to the equations of motion.
Mm-hmm.
That's one.
Mm-hmm.
And physical mode condition, meaning that eta of tau is the growing solution to the equation of motion. It's only in this second instance that you can evolve consistency relations all the way to modern days and late time.
Yeah, because I remember that ultra slow roll violates consistency conditions. Right. So now you are saying it has been understood what the problem is. Yeah. So the problem is that the adiabatic mode is not growing.
Exactly. The adiabatic mode is constant, but you have another solution to the equations of motion, which is growing.
Yes. And okay.
If you want, in very layman terms, no.
Yeah. Basically. So basically, you are saying that this soft mode is not a symmetry in that sense. Yeah, because the symmetry would be adiabatic mode. Adiabatic mode is there, but it's kind of subdominant. Yeah, and the dominant one, which we measure, doesn't correspond to the symmetry.
Yeah, exactly. Very good. Yeah, this is a very good way of phrasing it. Not meaning, say, for example, when we study worded entities for standard Goldstones, what we say is simply that if you take the Goldstone at very small momentum and large wavelengths, it's equivalent to your global transformation, and therefore is the same as taking the original endpoint function in a rotated vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And this would be true for the equations for consistency relations if your matter field for Q that goes to zero reduces to a symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the case for ultra slow roll, because the symmetry is the constant mode.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
While of course the matter fluctuation evolves with the growing mode because that's the dominant one at late times.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, so but this so constant is still adiabatic mode as far as I remember, and the growing one is kind of something else. I don't know. Yeah, it just turns out kind of the usual picture, I think, turns upside down. So adiabatic mode, normally adiabatic mode is growing and the Isaac curvature or whatever is decaying, yeah? But here it's kind of somehow in slow roll, it's just opposite or some.
Yeah. So maybe if you want, I don't know, I guess it's a matter of definitions, but what I would call right now in light of this adiabatic mode is simply the Q to zero limit of your symmetry transformation.
Okay.
And then the growing mode is whatever describes the evolution of your matter field eventually. Right. In this case, for example, in the one that I'm talking about right now, they match. They're the same thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For ultra slow roll, they don't.
Yes.
They belong to different branches of the equations of motion.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes.
And that's what, but you still have, in principle, consistent acceleration. It's just that you cannot evolve them to late times.
Mm-hmm. Good.
All right, so yeah, very good, because this is the trickiest point. I always fail to explain this properly. But so then I won't bother you more with this derivation, because once you have that, you plug everything in the, oh my God, in the original equation that you had, which was this, and you recover precisely the consistent relations that I showed you before. So these are the three assumptions that go inside. Well, I'm cheating. There is, of course, the fact that everything falls at equal speed at large distances, right? So of course, there is the equivalence principle. Okay, so which means that if we observe violations of consistent acceleration, somehow we are observing violation of one of these assumptions, okay? Okay, I mostly commented it already, but it's to say that we already know that there are instances where consistent acceleration are violated. The most simple one is where you have, you know, inflationary models that just have other like degrees of freedoms, or there are these trickier instances where you actually have maybe single field, but extra decaying, non-decaying modes that effectively play the role as additional degrees of freedom. Okay. And the violation of the physical mode condition, this thing that we've discussed right now with Sergei, tells you essentially that the small Q limit is not smooth of the consistent relations, and in fact, poles could appear. And then the fact when you have other light degrees of freedom, you violate the requirement of Gaussian initial conditions, which means that now what you should really be doing is to take the probability distribution for initial condition with some extra, you know, small bispectrum or trispectrum and so on and so forth. And it's clear that these will modify how the probability distribution changes after your symmetry, and therefore will give you extra terms in the consistent relations, okay? And towards the end of the talk, I will give you an example of how this comes about. And in fact, we even tested it. Okay, so very good. This is the bottom line. If there is a violation of one of these assumptions, we expect consistent relations not to hold. So what we have done is to test them. To the best of my knowledge, this was the first time, essentially using n-body simulations for the simplest non-trivial observable that we can think of, which is the bispectrum. The bispectrum is nothing but the three-point function of the matter density, okay? And just let me remind you that for the bispectrum, the consistent relation reads the following, meaning that if you take bispectrum divided by power spectrum and you look at a small q, there are no poles. It's a regular function, okay? Okay, so these are a little bit of technical details. What you can do, you can just take your universe, put it in a box, you have a grid, then you evolve your particles according to essentially Newton's law. I'm not an expert in this, okay, knows much more on that, but essentially following Newton's law and eventually you end up with a snapshot of how the matter density looks at the universe at late time, okay? And for the first part of our analysis, we had 40 realizations with Gaussian initial conditions. So we took our initial conditions to be exactly Gaussian, okay? In which case, we do not expect violation of consistency relations. We have a bunch of boring stuff, and these are we don't care that much. But the only thing is that we measure everything today, so at zero redshift, so that we know that the right-hand side of consistent acceleration cancels exactly because everything is measured at equal time, okay? Very good. So the first thing that you got to, there are now, so the reason why it took us 5 years to publish the first paper is because, probably because I'm dumb and I don't know how to do these things, but also because it's very complicated. There are a lot of subtleties related to the fact that now you are studying the squeezed limit of your bispectrum, which first of all was somewhat unexplored, but you're taking the squeezed limit on a grid because you have a simulation. So there are some subtleties, which I'm going to try to explain. The first thing is that we need to understand is that we need to parameterize the bispectrum this way. You know, the bispectrum is a function of three momenta. These three momenta respect conservation of momentum. And so you can parameterize them as a triangle that closes on itself. And typically the bispectrum is parameterized in terms of the three lengths of the sides of the triangle. But that's not the best way of doing it, because when you want to take now the squeezed limit of this triangle, meaning you want to make one of the legs smaller and smaller and study how the bispectrum behaves when you do that. And if you label the bispectrum based on the three legs, that's problematic because two of them change when you take the squeezed limit and only one stays fixed. So it turns out that the best way of doing things is to keep the angle between the softest and the hardest mode fixed, the hardest mode fixed as well, and then just send this guy to zero. Once you do that, then at the practical level, consistency relations tells you that the bispectrum can be written as a power series in Q of this form, okay? And the cool thing is that the dependence on the soft mode, it's what consistency relations predict. Essentially, the power spectrum times powers of Q, okay? And these, since it's in the soft limit, this is stuff that you can compute from perturbation theory. It evolves linearly and so on and so forth. All the complicated stuff that comes from the nonlinearities of the gravitational evolution falls into these coefficients here that depend on the hard momentum and on the angle, okay? But the nice thing is that consistency relations essentially predict a factorization of these two dependencies, which means that these guys here, you can effectively consider them as parameters to fit from the data. You don't need to assume any knowledge on them. And practically, of course, you also want to stop at some order. And this we will determine it just by looking at what's the best fit, how many parameters do we have to include to describe well your data. Okay. And in this language, consistency relations tells you that you have no poles, meaning that these two coefficients here have to be identically zero. Okay, very good. And this is, again, as I said, model independent because we don't assume anything on this complicated stuff. However, there is, as I told you, a first subtlety, which is the one that took me the most to figure out, and is the fact that since the dependence on k and theta is unknown, we might as well average over all of them. However, once you are on a discrete grid, as it happens for n-body simulations, not all values of k and theta are allowed because your triangle can only occupy discrete points. Okay. And in particular, what discrete points you can occupy, meaning what values of k and theta are allowed, depend on what value of q you're looking at. So the set of allowed for the angles, for example, it's already obvious. Now, if you look at this picture, if I look at this value of q or this value of q, I have a different set of possible angles. Okay. Which means that if I'm not careful and I just average over all possible angles and over all possible hard modes, I will inherit some spurious Q dependence that only comes from the fact that I have a grid. And that's very annoying, and I'll show you how. To simplify things, but actually not that much, what you do when you average your bispectrum, for example, over hard modes and angles is to do it over the grid. So you take your bispectrum, you multiply it by how many triangles fall in that particular range of Q, and then you normalize it, okay, by the total number of triangles that you have counted on. However, this number of triangles, as I told you, does depend on Q, which means that now if you carry on the procedure, your averaged fitting parameter depends on Q. And it depends on Q in a way that you cannot predict, because the original coefficient A is what you cannot predict in perturbation theory, sorry. Okay. And this is very unfortunate because it spoils the nice factorization that we had following Frankenstein's tessellations. So it's annoying, but at the same time, just looking at this reasoning here, it tells you how to cure this. Meaning the only thing that you have to do is to take your grid. As you see, this is only a property. This is only a property of the grid itself. So you can take your grid and you can literally just count how many triangles you have for each value of the soft mode. And you can renormalize your data by that number of triangles. And when you do that, you will explicitly cancel out this spurious Q dependence here. And your final average is nice, meaning you have some object that does not depend on Q, and then you have an object that depends on Q, but that you know very well. And you can test that this works on, for example, perturbation. You can buy some perturbative expression for the bispectrum and measure it on your grid and show that the factorization holds quite well if you do this correction. Modulo very soft points that unfortunately are still problematic. And so we weren't able to eliminate the problem from these points here, so we just discarded it, okay? Is this clear so far, more or less? Okay, so the bottom line is that if you're on a grid, things can get tricky. And I have to be honest, it's not clear to me to what extent this applies to real data as well, but I think it does because eventually every survey has pixels. So you do measure stuff only on a discrete subset. So you have to be careful about these things.
Yeah, actually, Angela, I'm surprised that you start from the second bin. So bin is really like the first momentum on the lattice. Yeah, so that's...
This one?
Yeah, so that's the biggest... Yeah.
Is the longest wavelength, yeah.
Right, but that seems to be very sensitive to, I mean, that's numerical artifact completely. So,
it's not the zero mode. No, sorry, this is not the zero mode.
Yeah, then I probably didn't get. So, what is that actually?
It's just the softest Q you can achieve on the grid. So, if you want, is twice the fundamental mode of your grid.
Well, okay, so it's not zero mode, it's first mode.
It's first mode, yes.
But first mode is also very sensitive to your periodic boundary conditions, to your cubic box, everything, yeah?
Oh, true, very good. In fact, I think it's not a problem because in fact, at a certain point, we spent a lot of time thinking about this because we were exactly wondering, could it be that the data that we're looking at, I mean, the ultra soft ones, are precisely the ones that are spoiled by, for example, boundary conditions of your cube? And it turns out that no, it's because consistent tessellations are not broken by periodic boundary conditions. They should hold exactly the same if your boundary conditions are periodic, because the only thing that you see in your equations of motion are velocities, which are gradients of potentials, and gradients of the gravitational potential.
Okay.
So you're not sensitive to periodic boundary conditions.
Right, but your transformation is linearly growing in the Newtonian potential, yeah? I mean, your transformation is linearly growing Newtonian potential.
Yes.
So that cannot be periodic.
No, but the point is that since the equations of motion only see the gradient of that, even if you take a periodic growing, so something is sort of like, what's it called? No, a shark tooth.
Yeah.
Consistent tessellations still hold.
Well, I'm not sure I understand why, but okay, maybe we can discuss it.
Yeah, I think this is something that one has to do paper and pen essentially. But if you say okay, I have some growing, so phi gets translated by something that is linear in x.
Yeah, that's what I need to do. Yeah,
but periodic.
Yeah, but then you have jumps. Yeah, then you have delta functions and your gradients. It doesn't look good.
No, but in the bulk, you never see it unless you are exactly at the edge. That's the point. Meaning
that's
the
true.
Gradient, it's constant everywhere except for something that is exactly localized at the boundary of your box.
True, but why this, you know, this thing doesn't propagate from the boundary inside? I mean, you have long-range force and everything, so not at all obvious. That's not a problem.
Good. Yeah, I don't think I have an answer on right now. I know that I had an answer years ago. But I probably had it written somewhere. We spent some time thinking about this, but yes. And it's also important because, well, okay, I'm going to tell you later in a few more slides, but it turns out that probably if you want to measure FNL, this bin starts to become important. Mm-hmm. But because this is also the bin that is, of course, it's most sensitive to consistency relations themselves.
That's
so
right.
If you have small violations, you're going to see it in that bin the most.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to take it very empirically, the thing that I'm going to show you now is that periodic boundary conditions do not seem to influence consistency relations, at least empirically, meaning that we are able to test them on n-body simulations, mm-hmm. because otherwise it would not work.
No, sure. No, I think it should be okay for some modes, I don't know, starting from Q high enough. The question is where this enough is, and you are saying this is just like two is enough, yeah? One is enough.
I'm everything I'm going to say now is actually starting from four. So now I don't know.
Okay, more like enough, yeah.
I don't know why four sounds
more than enough, but more like enough.
So. Yes, exactly. I don't have a quantitative argument to say four, it's better than two. I have to be honest. It's more something.
No, but actually it's surprising that four is already good. I would say it's actually surprising. Yeah, so that's, I can understand that can be, but quite surprising.
Four, it turns out to be already good, yes.
Okay.
And from what we are seeing now, it's actually four could also be good even when you have violations of consistency relations. We're mm-hmm. pretty close to the real value. I'll tell you what I mean in a second, but yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, it's a good point. I mean, there are a number of subtleties that one has to think about. Of course, you're talking about the box here, but this could apply just to say the finite extent of a survey. So everything that I'm saying now is just a schematic theme for real experiments. And hopefully we'll make it more and more concrete eventually.
But just to follow up on this point.
Yes.
So for the previous plot, you weren't showing the error bars, I guess, on this ratio.
There is no error bar here because we literally took just the perturbation theory expression.
Right, but your simulations must have some level of sample variance, right?
Yeah. No, I will have them. Of course, we will have error bars eventually. No, I'm just saying that here we were interested in checking whether our procedure to eliminate this spurious Q dependence worked.
Yeah, right. So my question was whether or not this discrepancy you're seeing at the lowest Qs is larger than the sample variance or not.
It is. And... you can show that it is simply very stupidly, because if you still include this bin even after polishing, if you want your spurious Q dependence, you cannot recover consistency relations. And yeah. Okay. Unfortunately, we don't have a handle to say it exactly, because at the same time, we cannot perform this test on the real simulations, because those are in the nonlinear regime. So we don't have an analytic handle to compute this spurious Q dependence. But if you buy the same discrepancy, which I'm not sure about, but you could, then it is larger than the sample variance. Does this answer your question?
Sure, yeah, okay.
Just to be clear, one is the prediction and the dots are what you're getting.
Yes, exactly. One is the prediction, meaning if you have exact factorization, meaning that you are able to completely cancel this spurious Q dependence. Here I'm plotting a ratio between the perfectly factorized quantity and the quantity that we computed on our grid. If you have exact factorization, this has to be one.
And then to address Sergey, if I understand it right, so you have limitation going into larger boxes, wouldn't you like do twice as big a box or?
Yeah, no, there we really have practical limitation, let's put it this way, yeah. Of course, ideally, so practically, if one day we have a recipe that is, stable enough, of course, we want to test it on some more extensive simulation with larger boxes, or say, yeah, exactly. But at this stage, we cannot do better than that, unfortunately. You might not, yeah, so there are two ways that you can do it. You can either make your box larger, so that you decrease the minimum possible Q, or you make your grid finer so that you increase the possible value for K. Because the only thing that you really care about when you're testing consistency relation is the ratio between your hard mode and your soft mode. And of course, you can either do that, you can make that ratio smaller by making your box larger, so Q smaller, or making your grid finer, so you get K larger. So far, we had to live with these. These are all simulations that Roman Scocimaro had from other stuff, and we had to work with those. Because I think these are quite computationally expensive. All right. Bottom line, okay, we, of course, to be practical, we also been in the soft mode, but that's not that interesting. And to be completely model independent, we also actually don't assume anything on the power spectrum. We measure these quantities directly from data, okay? And our data are for hard modes that are in this range, which correspond to this thing here. And this delta squared is essentially a measure of how nonlinear your data are. So this is just to tell you that, as I was promising you, we are testing them on fully nonlinear data. So there is no way this delta is like between 5 and 10. There is no way the perturbation theory applies to our data. Okay. Few words about the analysis. It's probably something that people can do much better than me, but the idea is that we do a likelihood analysis. The only subtle thing is that since now we want to be really model independent, so we're measuring both the bispectrum and the model, essentially the power spectrum, from data. Now you have associated uncertainties on both of them, which turns out to be a pain, because now it means that the covariance matrix depends on the parameters that you want to estimate. So this likelihood is not Gaussian in the parameters at all. So you got to do some smart sampling, or I'm doing some Newton-Raphson method where I solve it. I maximize the likelihood iteratively. And then we judge the goodness of the fit using this Bayesian information criterion that I'm told, because I'm not an expert, but I'm told that it's proven to be consistent, meaning that for a large enough sample, it always penalizes overfitted models. Because that's the most important thing for us. We don't want to have models that are overfitted, meaning that predict more parameters than there should be, because the number of parameters is precisely our prediction. Okay? The absence of two of these parameters in particular. And these are the result. This is just to show that there are some fits that are better than the others, but this is, if you want, this is the money plot. Smallest BIC select better models. And here the BIC tells us that the best model is the one where we include A0 and A1. If you don't remember what they are, it essentially means that we include the order Q to the 0 and the order Q to the 1 term in the low Q expansion. Okay. And that's precisely what consistency relation tell you, meaning that you should not have an order Q to the minus 2 and an order Q to the minus 1 term. And indeed, if on top of this model, we add these divergences by hand, first of all, the fit gets worse, and we always get something that is consistent with 0. Okay. And this is further, if you want, substantiated by looking at the residues and showing that simply that the A0, A1 model, the one without divergences, is the only one that does not present any kind of pattern in the residues. Okay. And we take these as a proof that consistency relations do apply to n-body simulations in the nonlinear regime when you have Gaussian initial conditions. Okay, is this clear? Okay. So if this is clear, then we can go to the next step. Meaning, sorry, how am I doing with time? I have how long? Like 10 minutes, something?
Yeah, you can go like 5 minutes. We started 5 minutes late, so you can.
Okay, so I think 10 minutes is perfectly fine. The next thing that we did is to test the violation of consistency relation. And if you remember, I showed you that one possible violation is to have extra degrees of freedom that give you non-Gaussian initial conditions, okay? And these, you can simulate it using this model. It's called FNL. It's motivated by these Hurvatov models for inflation. But very roughly speaking, it's something like this. You generate a Bardeen potential, meaning your initial gravitational potential in the following way. You take a field phi that is Gaussian, and you correct it with some quadratic part. So it's clear that even though phi is Gaussian, capital phi is not, because it depends quadratically on a Gaussian field, okay? And the measure of how non-Gaussian you are is this number here, is called FNL, okay? And in our simulation, we can generate initial conditions according to this distribution here, and we use FNL equal to 100, which is a big number, but we want to do it to amplify the effects to make sure that we see violations, okay? Unfortunately for this, we have fewer realizations available, so our statistics is a little bit worse, but I think we can still prove the point. And you actually don't have to do anything. You take exactly the same analysis that you showed that works on consistent simulation with Gaussian initial conditions, and you apply to the new data with non-Gaussian initial conditions. And you can even see by eye that the model that was a good model before is not a good model anymore. So if you do not include divergences, you don't have a good description of the data. Okay. And in fact, you can show that if you now do include divergences, the fit always improves. Okay. So this was the extent that we went to in our first paper. And just to summarize, we essentially learned that consistent simulations are stable, meaning that they are robust and they apply to the fully nonlinear regime, and you can test them with n-body simulations, and in particular, you can test their violations, which, if you want, is the most interesting part, okay? And given this gives us hope that maybe this one day could be applicable to real observations, and in fact, let me maybe spend the remaining 5 minutes or something, tell you what we would like to do in the future. And we are close to finishing step one. There are still some subtleties to polish, but I think we're close to finish step one. Because the point is that you can actually do a little bit more. There are some non-perturbative predictions for how the Q to the minus two pole looks like when you have non-Gaussian initial conditions. And in particular, very roughly speaking, the coefficient in front of the Q to the minus two pole depends on FNL itself, even in the non-perturbative regime. Which means that if you can measure this, what I call the A minus two coefficient that you fit from data, then from that coefficient, you can extract the value of FNL. Okay? And that would be the first step, to actually measure FNL, rather than just say you are consistent with a non-zero FNL. It would be great to know what the value of FNL is. There are a number of subtleties here to address again. And the subtleties are, for example, the fact that you are very sensitive to the role of the transfer function. It's important to do the angular average properly. And so far, we are still struggling with a slightly unbiased likelihood. I can tell you where we are. We're measuring FNL that is something like 112 plus or minus 5. So we're like yay close to the real value. It's just that we have a likelihood that is still a little bit biased, so we have to work on it. But we're close, okay? This would be the step one. But this is still on simplified stuff, as Sergei was saying, meaning on very simple equations of motion just for matter density. But the nice thing is that consistent simulations should apply also for relativistically messy observables because they're non-perturbative. And in particular, they also apply for to fluctuations in the galaxy density. Okay? And the equation of motion are not too different from the one that I showed you before. What changes is that now, of course, you can have different species. Okay, you have baryons of different kinds, for example, and stuff like that. And as I was telling you, of course, galaxies can be created that can be destroyed, which means that now you have a source term for their mass density. But they can also be subject to different forces that is not just the gravitational one. So you have also some external force here. But you see, as long as you assume essentially frame invariance, meaning that these two objects on the right-hand side only depends on the density, on the gradient of the velocity, and on the difference of velocities, these equations enjoy exactly the same symmetries that I showed you before. And therefore, consistent simulations apply equally well with literally the same expression to galaxy densities, which is what eventually you want to measure. But even more practically, we know that in real life, you never, the third direction, if you want, the direction, the distance of a galaxy along the line of sight is never measured in real space, because that's hard to do. What you do is that you measure it in redshift space. So you only know, you know the angular position of your galaxy, and you know how far in time you measure it. What's the redshift for the galaxy? And it's very easy to convert from physical position to redshift space. And again, it turns out that modulo some mild modification on the right-hand side, consistency relations hold equally true also in redshift space. And in particular, at equal time, again, they are, again, exactly identical as before. Okay. So this would be the hope, meaning in a few years, if we manage to polish this whole analysis, to try to apply it to some concrete stuff, where the end goal would be galaxy densities in redshift space. Okay. And okay, so I'm done. Maybe I can summarize, but I think I said most of these things. Consistency relations are interesting because they are robust, but they are actually really interesting because they can fail. And the fact that they can fail, it means that you can test them on data, and from their possible violation, you can learn stuff about physics. And in particular, they can tell you something about the initial conditions of the universe, or if you want, violation of the equivalence principle. And so far, we have tested them in the simplest possible scenario. The idea would be to have a whole program that goes on up to realistic measurements. And of course, I'm not saying that this is the holy grail of primordial non-Gaussianities, because of course one can still use perturbation theory on a plethora of data you will have. But it is a theoretical approach that applies to a different set of data, so that it would be complementary, right? And you know, to the very least, two measurements that are compatible, if you combine them, they have a smaller error. So that would be a nice thing to do. And I think that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Angelo.
Yeah, I have a question. So idea came to me, I mean, during your talk. So so these consistent conditions, they are valid for arbitrary correlators. In particular, instead of the correlator of short modes, you can put counts in cell statistics, which is very easy to measure on the lattice. And I don't know what will be in the real data, but on the lattice, that's what they like. Yeah, that basically you take counts in cells, you mean you put some regions and just count the number of particles you have inside.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And you have a distribution, and you can build the distribution putting these regions in different places. Yeah. So that's one of the basic statistics they use in the lattice. And I think here there must be some kind of correlator between this statistics and the long wavelength modes.
You're thinking about your counting, mode counting, I don't remember the name, but as the
counting cells.
Counting cells operator has the hard part of the correlator.
Yeah, that's the hard part of the correlator.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I don't know how to compute, but it's very easy to measure on the lattice. And then, yeah, the kind of to consider correlator, which is this counts in cells correlated with soft mode.
Yes.
Yeah, I think if we think for like 10 minutes, we'll build an observable like this, yeah?
Yeah, in fact, sorry, aren't the counting cell isn't just a smart integral. I mean, you're integrating your density over some top hat
function. Yeah, of course, it's just
like
integral of the density. Sure, right. It's just integral of the density over region. But no, I'm talking about the PDF of the, I mean, counting cell itself is just density, yeah? Mm-hmm. But now I don't want just to take average of this density. I want to really take the full distribution of this
sure,
density.
Sure, sure,
yeah.
sure, sure.
So it's some, but in principle, it's kind of, it should be equivalent to all the correlators that you can build, you know, out of the density field. And there must be some kind of consistency relation for correlators of long modes together with these counts in cells, yeah?
Yeah, I would say so, because the counting cell is just, it's a functional of your density, right? The tricky part to derive consistency relation is always to understand how your initial conditions transform, right? But initial conditions for counting cell is just the initial condition of the densities, which are in the linear regime, you know everything about. Yeah. So there is no, in the sense, I understand what you're saying. So it's complicated to know what is the late time probability distribution for the count itself.
Yes.
Yeah. But the initial time, it's a simple thing. And the only thing that enters the derivation of consistency relation is the initial time, if you know, if you're smart about how these things evolve in time.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. So exactly. But that's precisely the idea, to measure some kind of consistency relation that would involve a low mode, which we know how to evolve. And okay, we'll just derive the same consistency relations and counts in cells and see what happens.
Yeah, I would say that, yeah, you're right.
And that's probably easier to measure on the lattice than correlators. Yeah, I mean, that's the usual problem, to measure correlates, all these triangles and stuff. Counts and cells is so easy to measure. It's really like the first thing you can imagine to measure once you have data. As actually it was the case with Hubble, yeah? The different thing he measured once he got data.
Yeah,
like and his data were much worse than yours. Yours are much better.
Good, but good, very interesting. But sorry, no, the thing that I don't fully understand is, what wouldn't you correlate the counting cell with the soft mode? Or what do you do?
Yeah, what kind of observer? No, that we have to sit down and write maybe for 10 minutes. But it's kind of distribution. I want to correlate counts and cell distribution with the mode. Right. Yeah, I can correlate all momentum of the distribution. Yeah, if I were talking about momentum of the distribution, that's trivial.
Sergey, like, so isn't this exactly what Marilena and her student measured like recently?
Perhaps, but did they? They probably didn't. I don't remember putting them as consistency conditions. But yeah, that's true. That sounds like what similar to what they did. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm not
measuring the response of these, you know, counts and cells, the PDFs. Like, you know, well, they're measuring the response to these soft modes, right?
Right, right. So now we just want to put it in the, cast it in the form of consistency conditions.
Yeah.
Sorry, by the response of these soft modes, you are saying that essentially I do count, I still have, I count in cell stuff, but I do it in a background that is slowly modulated?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, yeah. Which I mentioned, I mean, it should be the consequence of just, you know, equivalence principle, not in a slowly modulated background, and you assume the stuff fall at the same,
They did something, because they went that's maybe the difference, because they went, I think, to next order, to curvature, how this thing reacts to curvature, the second derivatives of the density, which is beyond consistency conditions, which is also interesting, and it's an interesting observable. But we basically don't need to go that far. We just go to the gradients. I was saying second derivatives of the potential, not the density. Yeah, so they went to second derivatives of the potential, like curvature term. What we want to do is just linear.
I thought that they also measured the linear response, but maybe I'm misremembering what they did.
No, they must have done that, but well, maybe, or also not, no, it's not obvious, because linear response is basically how this thing starts moving. Yeah. So maybe they didn't want the cells to move, but yeah, it's true. I mean, that's similar. I mean, they did definitely something along these lines. Yes. Yeah, so that sounds very, very much related. I just don't remember them putting like in the way of consistency conditions.
Right.
That's interesting. We can think about it. Yeah, as you said, I'm sure that to find the right observable is somewhat trivial, because again, it's, you go essentially through the same steps with the only difference is that now you have this funky top hat stuff. But it's still not super clear to me what it means now to correlate stuff, because as you said, it's it's not clear. The statistics for the counting cell, right, is as a function of, what is the variable there? Is the radius over which you are counting stuff?
No, radius is fixed, just total amount of matter inside.
Yeah, so your delta that you're measuring here is smooth on some scale, and then you're PDF of that delta.
Yeah, no, I'm saying, sorry, but the radius of your smoothing box is the analog of our momentum K, for example.
Yep. Right.
It's a label, and then okay. Then, yeah, maybe you're going to have some correlators for counting cells at different radii, for example, or stuff like that. I don't know.
No, I went for a single radius, you get non-trivial information, because you see, for a single radius, we are talking about really distribution, not just correlator. So in fact, well, I can compute various moment of the distribution. Moment of the distribution would be exactly correlators. Well, some That's integrals right. of the correlators. Yeah.
That's right.
But I think we can go a bit like beyond just moment, and should be a way to write down kind of correlation between probability distribution and the mode. No, I agree. It's not obvious. I'm not. Yeah, I mean, have to write something to figure it out. But there must be a way to figure it out.
No, yeah, but I understand what you're saying. Yeah,
to construct at least from momenta, you know.
Sorry to interrupt. There is a question from Alex.
Oh yeah, I was just wondering, what about the consistency relations at unequal time correlators?
Oh, perfect. Yes, I think that should be like step five of what I said. How can I phrase it? Just a second. Yeah. So when you have an equal time, let me show you again maybe the equation for consistency relations. Oh no. When you have an equal time, yeah, it gives you a right hand side essentially. And you can show that what happens is that you have again divergences. Okay. So I mean the bispectrum divided by the power spectrum would be divergent. Actually, no, I think this is the best formula to show it to you. Sorry. This one. Oh, no, I don't have it. Well, okay, forget about it. You would have divergences exactly like in this case, but now with a coefficient that is proportional to the difference in the growth factor at different times, okay? So you still, it's perfectly computable, it's predicted, but you have to be careful because now you could misinterpret some FNL, well, you could actually misinterpret some unequal time measurement for some FNL. Is this what you were asking?
Yeah, exactly.
You have to be careful about unequal time. As I said before, it's for hard modes, as the one that we're interested in, at late times, it's hard to measure them really at different times because they are very hard. And at the same time, they're constrained to be within the observable horizon. So they are typically very close to each other in time because essentially hard modes, to be hard enough to be interesting for us, they need to have had enough time to evolve, which means they have to be close in time to each other within the observable horizon. However, one has to be careful because you could have some spurious time dependence that simulate a pole, and you could interpret it as some FNL, which is not. So yeah, if you want, I'm on the to-do list to get this to a realistic thing is also to include possible unequal time measurements. Is that clear?
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. Well, I also have a quick question. Like you showed the case of like a local FNL, right?
Yes.
But what about other shapes?
For other shapes, I mean, the idea that consistency relations can be violated applies equally well.
Yeah.
I'm not aware though of, but it might be my own ignorance, but I'm not aware of non-perturbative predictions on how this violation happens. For FNL is quite local. FNL is quite nice because you have this nice non-perturbative prediction that in principle allows you to, gives you a handle to measure FNL from consistency relations. For the non-local stuff, for example, I'm not sure if anyone ever did anything. But of course, if you see violation of consistency relation, that's already a yes-no answer. I mean, Gauss initial condition or not Gauss initial condition. Then within this not Gauss initial condition, you could have all sorts of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, at that point, you have to come up with smart ways to predict how this stuff would affect consistency relation so you can use the measurements. Otherwise, but already having, you know, something is statistically relevant to say no is not consistent with Gauss initial condition, it would be huge. Then what model gives you those non-Gaussianities is a whole different story.
Okay, thanks.
So if there are no more questions for now, maybe we can stop the recording here and thank Angelo again.
Thank you. Thanks for the attention.